Well, we are at our 25th study in the series Ask the Exiles in the book of Esther. It's study number 6. And the book of Esther is the only book in the Bible, of course, that doesn't contain the name of God. None of the characters address God as far as the way it's written is concerned. And no divine work of providence is attributed to God by the writer in the story. But yet we know and we can see, and we've seen so far, the hand of God all over it. And God is at work. We have learned that Esther, the Jewish orphan raised by her cousin Mordecai, had been chosen by King Ahasuerus to be his queen. And because of her, not only her outer beauty, but her inner beauty as well. And we asked ourselves the question, have I something that God could use? Then the next question in our next study was this, can I lose sight of who I am? And we saw that even though Esther entered palace life, she never forgot who she was. We could see she remembered her background. She remembered the integrity with which she'd been brought up under Mordecai. She didn't lose sight of who she was. And that's a challenge to us as we go into different environments, school, college, different workplaces, and so on. Are we who we are at home when we're in public? And are we those who appear to be something else? Then the next question was, does it matter to me what God thinks about things? In Mordecai's case, the stand he took in doing that came at a cost. It had created a nationwide crisis for all Jews, and Mordecai's action had enraged a descendant of the Amalekites called Haman, who hatched a shocking plan to annihilate all the Jews. Well, Mordecai sees Esther, who's now queen, as the only hope of turning this situation around. And that's when he utters those famous words to her, who knows whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this, Esther 4 and 14. And looking at Esther's response, we use this question, am I expecting God to do through others what I could do? Because initially she goes, well, do you know, you just can't walk into the king. And she put up some excuses, but then she resigned herself to the task. And that led to our next question, which was, what can happen when I am fully yielded to God? That was what we looked at last week. And we started to see amazing things occur. And we'll see more of them now today. Why? Because Esther was fully yielded to God. It cost her to be fully yielded to God. But she went on with it and didn't look back. And God came in a powerful and in an amazing way. So today's question is this. Have I any unfinished business? Have I any unfinished business? Now, I'm not thinking of you, woman whose husband started a DIY job and it's still never been done, although if the cap fits, wear it. But it's a question to yourselves, and we're going to look for the answer here in the life of Esther. So Esther chapter 7, verse 1. So the king and Haman came to banquet with Esther the queen. And the king said again unto Esther on the second day at the banquet of wine, what is thy petition, Queen Esther? And it shall be granted thee, and what is thy request? And it shall be performed even to the half of the kingdom. Then Esther the queen answered and said, if I have found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition. Really what she's saying there is, let my life be spared. I'm sure the king goes, what? Let my life be spared. And he'd be scratching his head and thinking, how is Esther's life in danger? Verse 3 at the end of the verse. Let my life be given me at thy petition and of my people at my request. Or to put it another way, I and my people have been sold to be destroyed. Sorry, verse 4 reads this way. I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet because no such distress would justify disturbing the king. So there's her explanation. She's getting to the point. Do you remember after the first request when the scepter was held out and then the first banquet, we were thinking, why is she not asked for what she's supposed to ask for? Now she has waited, and we'll see the importance of that as it unfolds. But it's at this point she is letting the king know that this is not a petty thing. This is not an unreasonable thing that she's coming here. It's not the same as if they were merely going to be in bondage as slaves. This is annihilation. This is on a completely different level, and it involves her. Verse 5, then King Ahasuerus answered and said unto Esther the queen, who is he and where is he that durst presume in his heart to do so? Can you imagine her heart beating at this stage? And Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. Now remember, this is a banquet, just the king, Haman, and herself. Now she said it, and it can't be unsaid. The truth has come out. She has waited. She has taken her time. She has chosen her moment. And it makes me think of the words she said earlier, if I perish, I perish. Well, this is the moment when those words are bound to be echoing in her mind. This is it. If I perish, I perish. Yielded. Can you imagine how earlier on she had breathed a sigh of relief away whenever she got on the royal apparel and stood where the king would see her and waited for the scepter to be, and he held it out. Wow. Then she said, would you come to a banquet? Just Haman and you and myself? And they came. The king agreed. Relief. And then he agreed to come to the next banquet on this occasion that we're reading about here. Again, sigh of relief. But now she has uttered the words. Now she has said what we thought she should have said on day one. And she has said these words against the very man that the king had personally elevated into such a prominent position, Haman. She wasn't talking about some obscure person or some enemy, a known enemy. This is the man sitting right there in front of her who just happened to have been elevated by the king. Verse 6, and Esther said, this, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. Then Haman was afraid before the king and the queen. And the king, arising from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden. And Haman stood up to make request for his life to Esther the queen, for he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. The tension would be palpable, wouldn't it? The king hasn't spoken a word in response, but his actions say it all. And Haman sees this. And Haman knows that it doesn't look good for him. I can picture the king pacing erratically up and down in the palace garden and trying to process this situation, while Esther and Haman are sitting amongst the remnants of what was a banquet. And the king's thinking, why did it have to be these two people? One, his chosen favoured queen, and the other has chosen favoured courtier. Verse 8. Then the king returned out of the palace garden into the place of the banquet of wine. And Haman was fallen upon the bed whereon Esther was. Now verse 7 has already informed us that Haman rose up to plead for his life in front of Esther. So we can assume that this posture is an expression of his desperate pleading. Because he's pleading for his life here. Then said the king, will he force the queen also before me in the house? Oh dear. The king sees something very different. When he looks at Haman's posture, he reads that situation very differently. And that's something we can all be guilty of, isn't it? We see something and we can read it very differently, jump to conclusions. And the king reads something impertinence in Haman's actions as he sees him lying across Esther's bed. Regardless now of Esther's accusation of genocide, this picture that's before the king's eyes of Haman prostrated across the queen's feet, perhaps, is enough to push Ahasuerus over the edge. Because this isn't the kind of behavior that King Ahasuerus will tolerate in his palace. As we look at the whole book and look at everything that we see, we can see the king's interaction with his queen. We can see the respect that he has for his queen. Over and over. Look at how many times he addresses her, Queen Esther. Respect. We can see how outraged he is when it seems that the queen isn't being respected by a man. This is the same king from chapter 1 to the end, and the respect that he shows to Esther. Of course, she showed respect to him. There was mutual respect here. So however conflicted the king was in his mind over Haman's wicked scheme, he is now insulted by Haman's inappropriate behavior towards Esther, to the point that he must be put to death. Verse 9, and Harbona, one of the chamberlains, said before the king, behold also the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman had made for Mordecai, who had spoken good for the king. The gallows standeth in the house of Haman. Harbona said, look, just look out that window. See that big tall contraption there? It's either a spike for impalement or some other method of execution. But that was designed by Haman for Mordecai. Well, that's enough. Then the king said, hang him thereon. And so they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified. It makes me think of some words of wisdom that we have in other places in the Word of God. For example, Proverbs chapter 26 and verse 27. Whoso diggeth a pit shall fall therein, and he that rolleth a stone, it will return upon him. Ecclesiastes 10 and 8. He that diggeth a pit shall fall into it, and whoso breaketh a hedge, a serpent shall bite him, and whoso removeth a stone shall be hurt therewith. And what you're getting there is an idea of someone who tries to do something in their plan, but the very thing that they plan can turn on them. And God's able to do that. We should be careful, shouldn't we? In our schemes and our devices. Because God's able to turn things around. Not only did Mordecai, in just last week's study, not only did Mordecai get all that Haman had desired for himself. What shall we give to the man whom the king wants to honor? Do you remember? Not only did Mordecai get all that Haman had desired for himself, but Haman is now getting all that Haman desired for Mordecai. Can't you see the hand of God in the book? Chapter 8, verse 1. On that day did the king Ahasuerus give the house of Haman, the Jew's enemy, unto Esther the queen. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was unto her. And the king took off his ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it unto Mordecai, and Esther set Mordecai over all the house of Haman. So in these verses we can see that whatever household property belonged to Haman, including staff and so on, and mind you, it was big because the king had honored him and blessed him and prospered him. So this was a huge estate, really. It was now been handed over to Esther, and she was putting Mordecai in charge as manager. Now, if the book had ended there, we would be quite happy, I think, wouldn't we? We would be saying, that turned out well. We would have reasons to rejoice, and we could see clearly God's hand at work and his intervention on behalf of his people. But we can't forget something. That at this very moment, all over the Persian Empire, officials in every province still held letters from the king telling them and those in their provinces that on the 13th day of the month Adar, the 12th month of the year, they were to annihilate all the Jews. If you Google to find out the origins of 13 being unlucky, you'll find quite recent reasons. But this is the oldest reason for a 13th to have been considered to be unlucky. We're not looking for luck. We have God. But that's one of the reasons people cite for bad luck, a 13 being unlucky. If I had to live in a house that had a 13 on the door, it wouldn't bother me. And if I was to get married on the 13th, Jean, it wouldn't bother me, you know. In fact, you'd be thinking he was very lucky he got married at all. There was still that awful cloud hanging over the Jewish nation. Remember how many times in the exile story we've read these words, the decree that could not be altered. The decree of the Medes and the Persians which cannot be altered. And that brings in our question, doesn't it? Have I any unfinished business? See, it all turned out well for Esther. Really well. But there's unfinished business. And sometimes it can turn out well for us. But do we think about others? Do we think of the impact certain things will have on us? Do we think of the perishing of others? Do we think of others with this cloud hanging over them and us as believers in an assembly here? Do we think of the many who are perishing around us? Or do we really just think about, it's all right for me. I'm all right. I'm for heaven. What about the multitudes who are lost? Jesus came into this world to do a work and he finished it. He didn't leave this world with unfinished business. He finished it. The work that the Father gave him to do. He accomplished it. What about us? Have we stopped short of completing the race of the Christian life in the way that we should? Have we thrown in the towel over some incident or other? Isn't that so common amongst believers here in Northern Ireland? They've thrown in the towel. Something happened. Enough's enough. Unfinished business. The Lord's business goes on. You're still needed. Have we been thinking of our own plans lately and not of the Lord's plans? Have we unfinished business? I let the Holy Spirit put his finger on these issues in our own lives. Verse 3 of chapter 8. And Esther spake yet again before the king. She's not holding back now. And fell down at his feet and besought him with tears to put away the mischief of Haman the Agagite and his device that he had devised against the Jews. Then the king held out the golden scepter towards Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king and said, if it please the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seem right before the king, and I be pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to reverse the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews, which were in all the king's provinces. That would have included Israel, remember. For how can I endure to see the evil that shall come unto my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? Now this is what we thought, of course, Esther should have said at the very beginning. But then the story wouldn't have had all those amazing twists and turns. Do you remember? We questioned her holding back, but we reminded ourselves before we would judge her too harshly that she had just completed 3 days of fasting and had asked all around her to fast, and we believed that that was accompanied by crying unto God on her behalf. So God's leading here. But also there's something that has come to mind in looking at this, and it's the ingredient that the writer has included, made sure that we got, and it's the ingredient of ignorance, not knowing. Now, it has kept us in suspense and made the story very interesting. Of course it has. But it's an important ingredient. See, none of the characters on their own knew the whole story or saw the whole picture at any point as it played out. For example, King Ahasuerus, throughout most of the story, didn't know that Esther was a Jew. Haman didn't know Esther was a Jew. Haman didn't know that the man he hated so much was Esther's cousin. Mordecai didn't know why he wasn't honored at the time when he avoided a treasonous plot some chapters back. King Ahasuerus doesn't know about the bitter standoff between Haman and Mordecai. Esther didn't know that Haman had erected a gallows for Mordecai's execution. And Mordecai didn't know why Haman was so unexpectedly asked to lead him through the city in an honor parade. Why would it be Haman? So the writer of this book is making sure that we notice that there wasn't one of the characters in full possession of all the facts. Why is that important? Well, it shows us that not one of these characters could have done what they did through their own genius. Do you get it? Including Mordecai, including Esther. None of them could have engineered this through their own genius. And that's where we see God again. You and I don't know everything. And you see, when somebody comes to tell me something and unburden and explain a thing they're going through, I'm very aware that I'm only ever getting that one person's version of events. Because we don't know everything, but God knows everything and sees everything and understands everything and can process everything. And that's why we need to rely on God, isn't it? That's why we need to lean on Him. Truth is stranger than fiction. We've a wonderful book here, full of truth. And it's exciting. Verse 7 of chapter 8. Then King Ahasuerus said unto Esther the queen, to Mordecai the Jew, Behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and him have they hanged upon the gallows, because he laid his hand upon the Jews. Write ye also for the Jews as it liketh you, in the king's name. That's a powerful thing to do now in this particular generation. Seal it with the king's ring. Well, he'd just been given the king's ring. For the writing which is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's ring may no man reverse. Now, they've already got these letters that no man can reverse. And now Mordecai is being given an opportunity to do something. But the king does something very clever here. Verse 9. Then were the king's scribes called at that time in the third month, that is the month Sivan. So there was some time before this genocide was going to happen. On the 23rd day thereof, and it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded unto the Jews, and to the lieutenants, the deputies, rulers of the provinces, which are from India unto Ethiopia, and 127 provinces, unto every province according to the writing thereof, and unto every people after their language, to the Jews according to their writing, and according to their language. And he wrote in King Ahasuerus' name, and sealed it with the king's ring, and sent letters by post and horseback, and riders, and mules, camels, and young dromedaries, wherein the king granted the Jews, which were in every city, to gather themselves together and to stand for their life. So the first decree hasn't been rescinded. To destroy and slay and to cause to perish all the power of the people of the province who would assault them. Both little ones, women, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. Upon one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, namely upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar. So how were the Jews to be saved? Through self-defense. The original decree still stood. But the Jews were now to receive every assistance in protecting themselves against its implementation, verse 13. A copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people, and that the Jews should be ready against that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. A valuable lesson is being taught here in this course of action. Let's don't miss it. The first decree had gone out, wasn't rescinded, meaning that death and danger was waiting for the Jews. However, if they heeded the advice and the warning contained in this latest letter, they would survive the onslaught. The responsibility was theirs. Look at the language. Gather together. Stand for your life. Attack all the power of the people who would assault you. Be ready. Avenge yourselves. Makes us think, doesn't it, of Paul's words to the Ephesians chapter 6. The principalities, the powers, the rulers of the darkness of this world. Therefore, because of this, put on the whole armor of God. And not only that, take up the weapons of the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, praying always with all prayer and the word. God hasn't delivered us and given the devil a new letter. No, we still have the world, the flesh and the devil against us. But what God has done is, I'm going to give you every assistance to stand. Are you standing today? Are you together today? Verse 14. So the posts that rode upon mules and camels went out, being hastened and pressed on by the king's commandment, and the decree was given at Shushan the palace. And Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold, with a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. The Jews had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and every city, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness and a feast and a good day. From fasting to feasting, weeping may endure for the night, joy cometh in the morning. But they still hadn't reached 13th day of the 12th month. Verse 17. Every province and every city, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a good day. And, I think this is amazing, many of the people of the land became Jews. We often forget about that little detail, don't we? They became Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them. Now, that was a serious decision for anybody to make. It wasn't like one day getting up and deciding you're going to be a vegetarian. To become a Jew was a pretty serious thing. And it would involve them being welcomed into the fold. It would involve them being initiated into the fold. It would involve them being ritually cleansed on the part of women and circumcised on the part of men. This was a big deal. Verse 1 of chapter 9. Now, in the 12th month, so here we are. That is the month Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's commandment and decree drew near to be put in execution, in the day that the enemies of the Jews hoped to have power over them, though it was turned to the country that the Jews had ruled over them that hated them, the Jews gathered themselves together in the cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hand on such as sought their hurt. And no man could withstand them, for the fear of them fell on all people. And all the rulers of the provinces and lieutenants and deputies and officers of the king helped the Jews. What a turnaround. Because the fear of Mordecai fell on them. This is the man with the golden crown on now. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame went throughout all the provinces. For this man Mordecai waxed greater and greater. Thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword and slaughter and destruction, and did that, and did what they would unto those that hated them. Here's an interesting thing. In spite of all the warnings, in spite of all the assistance being given to the Jews, in spite of all the fear that permeated the land, so that many of the people who would have attacked the Jews decided not to, and many others decided to become Jews, in spite of that, there were still many who hated the Jews. Isn't that amazing? Some things never change. Some things never change. Have I any unfinished business? Well, you know, the old devil still has some unfinished business, and a lot of it concerns the Jews. Don't be surprised at the anti-Semitism and the hatred that there remains today in our world against the Jews. Verse 11 of chapter 9. On that day the number of those that were slain in Shushan the palace was brought before the king. And the king said unto Esther the queen, the Jews have slain and destroyed 500 in Shushan the palace. Imagine. The 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is thy petition and that shall be granted thee? Or what is thy request further? Now this is coming from him. You'd think she had got enough. But now he's going further still. Honour the Lord, you know. Be fully yielded to the Lord. And there's no telling what will happen. There's no limit on what God can do. If we don't yield to him, well, we're one of the problems, aren't we? Aren't we limiting? Verse 13, then said Esther, if it please the king, let it be granted unto the Jews which are in Shushan, to do tomorrow also according to this day's decree. And let Haman's 10 sons be hanged upon the gallows. And the king commanded it so to be done. And the decree was given at Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons. For the Jews that were in Shushan gathered themselves together on the 14th day also of month Adar, and slew 300 men at Shushan, but on the prey they laid not their hand. Remember the king had said, you could take whatever spoil you wanted. I thought this was a good testimony. I know it's a bit gory and bloodthirsty and all the rest of it. It's hard for us to get our mind around a lot of it. But they wouldn't lay their hands on the spoil. This was self-defense. They wanted that to be known. But the other Jews that were in the king's provinces gathered themselves together and stood for their lives and had rest from their enemies and slew their foes, 75,000. But they laid not their hands on the prey. On the 13th day of month Adar, 14th day of the same, rested they and made it a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews that were at Shushan assembled together on the 13th day thereof, and on the 14th day thereof, and on the 15th day of the same, they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore, the Jews of the villages that dwelt in the unwalled towns made the 14th day of the month Adar a day of gladness and feasting and a good day, and of sending portions one to another. And Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters unto all the Jews that were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, to establish this among them, that they should keep the 14th day of the month Adar and the 15th day of the same yearly. And verse 26 says, wherefore they called these days Purim, after the name of Pur. Pur was casting the lots. That's how they came up with that date in the first place. And of course, to this day, the feast of Purim is kept. Can you see how important that is to the Jewish people? I wonder, do they get the insights that we get as we look through this book? Well, you'll be glad to know that we've come to the end of this series. But here are the questions again as you leave. Have I something that God could use? Can I lose sight of who I am? Does it matter to me what God thinks about things? Am I expecting God to do through others what I could do? What can happen when I am fully yielded to God? What a story. Have I any unfinished business? May the Lord bless these thoughts to your hearts. And after I'm away and come back, we'll consider starting what exile have we left out? Nehemiah. And we'll see how we get on with him. And that might work in well with our building work that's going on here. So thank you very much for your patience this morning. I just wanted to finish that in this one session.